Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present veteran journalist John Bryan, who is opening a new alternative paper in San Francisco called Open City, and who's done some breathtaking work on the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. John, forgive the embarrassing intro, but I think you deserve the intro.
Well, thank you. Open City, by the way, is 35 years old. This is not the first issue. It's the 259th issue. And we just hit the streets with it, and I think people will enjoy it again.
All righty. Well,
to bring back the 60s issue.
Well, you're certainly opening up the publication with a very, very interesting and, to some, no doubt, very controversial topic, which is the death of JFK Jr. But before
That's our lead story.
Before we get to that subject, if you would fill us in a little bit about your journalistic background so that listeners have some familiarity with you.
Well, I come from a newspaper family, and I started in as a copy boy in the San Diego Tribune and went to a little weekly down there. I got my real first break working for the Chandler Publishing Corporation in Los Angeles. They used to publish a afternoon paper called the Mirror News. I broke in on the Mirror News. Then I went down to Mexico City, worked a couple of papers down there, came up to Houston, worked the Houston Post, Houston Chronicle, both makeup editor. And came to San Francisco to go to work on the San Francisco Examiner, doing the local editing for what they call the Bulldog Edition, which is the Advanced Sunday Edition. I also was their jazz editor and general assignment reporter. Went on to the Chronicle for a year, covered court, City Hall. Went down to Los Angeles for 3 years on the Herald Examiner, which was then the biggest PM in America and Hearst's biggest paper. I was a Sunday editor, and when I quit them, I was editing the Rotogravura magazine. I quit to go back to the underground press, which is what I've always loved. I was managing editor of the LA Free Press. Then I started up Open City in LA after it had run 14 issues in San Francisco and then joined the Free Press. We also published in San Francisco the Sunday paper and the Phoenix and Appeal to Reason. So under one name or another, or as a section of these other papers, Open City is very old, 35 years old.
Now, your work on the San Francisco Examiner obviously gave you some working familiarity with their journalistic procedures.
Yes.
And it was an apparent discontinuity in these procedures that first got you sniffing the air from a journalistic standpoint on the JFK, on the
JFK Jr.
Yeah, the JFK Jr. popped
off. So many Kennedys get popped off, it's hard to keep track.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, that first got you looking into the death of JFK Jr. Tell us about it, if you would.
Well, I'm very familiar with the Saturday edition of the Examiner. The last job I had with them, I was working in the back shop, pasting up the Saturday edition, among others. I know that the deadline is 6 a.m. They only publish one on Saturday, the 4-star. Usually it goes to camera just about 6 a.m., 6:05, 6:10. Having made up those front pages a good many times, I knew exactly when they hit. As it happened that day, that Saturday, July 17th, I had relied on the Examiner as my sole news source. I wasn't listening to radio, I wasn't watching television, and I glanced through it, and there was nothing at all in there about John F. Kennedy Jr. A friend in Houston called me and asked me for my opinion that evening, and I said, "What happened? It wasn't in the paper." And he said, "Well, Christ, it's the headline here." So I started, my ears went up as a journalist. This is a very important story. This was a man very prominent in the news.
The death of a president.
The nation's child, we used to call him. He was the one we all remember saluting his father's casket at the age of 3 after his father was assassinated in Dallas. The death of John F. Kennedy Jr., or even his appearance, could certainly not be ignored. It was a major, major story. It might even be the story of the year by the time all this is done. So I immediately began to investigate. I checked my sources at the Examiner, people who still work down there, and they said something odd had happened. They weren't sure exactly what it was or why, but I checked Associated Press, both the San Francisco Bureau and New York, and I discovered that first of all, it was NBC News which broke the story at 5 a.m. Pacific Coast time on July 17th. The plane apparently had gone down around 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on July 16th. The break hit at 5 a.m. on Channel 7, which is, excuse me, not Channel 7, Channel 4, NBC, which is owned by the Chronicle. The Examiner and the Chronicle, like most newspapers today, have 12 or 14 television sets going constantly in the city room, one television tuned to each channel. So there were at least two people in that city room watching those television sets at 5 a.m. Plus they got, you know, all these other connections, telephones, the net, you know, their own bureaus in Washington and around the world. There's no way in the world by 5 a.m. they could not have known that John F. Kennedy's plane had gone down. They knew. They definitely knew.
How do you account for the delay then?
Well, I checked the story further. As I say, Associated Press told me that they sent an advisory at 5:13 a.m. Pacific time to their clients, which included the Examiner, telling them their major bulletin was coming. The bulletin on John F. Kennedy's disappearance hit the Examiner at 5:30 a.m. Pacific time. They technically still had half an hour. It takes about 5 minutes to pull the story sent by satellite out of the computer and get it typeset. So by 5:35, they could have had the type and they could have had it pasted up by, say, 5:45. Now, my friends in camera checked the log for me. They discovered that the page one Saturday did not come into camera until 6:42, 42 minutes late, which means they had plenty of time. They had an hour and 42 minutes from the time that the NBC broke the story. They had more than an hour from the time that the story was in their computers. So they had the story, they knew that it occurred, and they deliberately blanked the story. And why they blanked the story is what I'm trying to find out. I think a lot of people in Washington and around the world in high places know that there was foul play in the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. They know the truth. I think eventually it's going to come out. And I'm asking the question of these two questions of a lot of people that I meet, hundreds of people, including a lot of important people I've telephoned. Question number one, do you think there was foul play in the death of John F. Kennedy Jr.? It's question number two, if so, why? And generally, we also discuss the way the media has handled it.
John, in an article that's already been published in the Anderson Valley Advertiser...
The article has been published in three places now, the Anderson Valley Advertiser, the Los Angeles Free Press, and Open City, the 35th anniversary issue, which just hit the streets this week.
You point out
three different papers, and it's on the net.
You also point out a number, in that article, you point out a number of interesting discrepancies between the facts and the official story.
Right.
Let's get into those. Tell us about Kyle Bailey. Who was he and what did he have to reveal?
Well, the Kyle Bailey quotes came out of a very reputable source, the New York Times. Kyle Bailey was a pilot who used the airport, the Essex, New Jersey airport, from which John F. Kennedy Jr. flew that ill-fated day, July 16th. Bailey had flown the same kind of plane, Piper Saratoga, a $350,000 single-engine plane, which Kennedy was flying that day. He said that he let me find the exact quote. Okay, just take me a second. He said that he was surprised by the manner in which Kennedy warmed up the plane and got ready to take off. And he thought there was something mechanically wrong with it, and he was going to warn Kennedy, but it was too late. The plane had already taken off. The other data, you want me to give you a quick rundown?
Well, one thing I want to point out, and you point out in your article, is that the plane was unguarded, that there was plenty of time for anybody who might have wanted to mess with it to do so, and that it also was completely anticipatable, to coin a term.
He had been going from Essex, New Jersey, 200 miles to Martha's Vineyard Island Airport every single Friday for months. It was predictable, just as predictable as rain.
You also point out that there are a lot of discrepancies in the official story. How far from Martha's Vineyard was he when he called the airport?
Well, let me run through a few of the discrepancies.
Sure,
okay.
Go ahead.
First of all, the fact of the matter that his Friday routine was so predictable. Secondly, he always flew with a flight instructor, but this particular week, the flight instructor suddenly had to go to Europe, and Kennedy had to fly by himself. Thirdly, Kennedy was known as a very careful pilot. He had put in more than twice the number of hours to get his flight permit. He was working on learning night instrumentation flying and was about to take his test in that area, so he was not completely deficient in knowledge of flying by instruments. He, as I already said, Bailey noted that there was something wrong with the plane. Exactly what, we're not sure, but it didn't sound right. Kennedy left late. His sister-in-law held him up, and he himself had trouble getting in there in time. So it was getting dark sooner than normally on his flights. He had notified, he was about 15 miles out from Martha's Vineyard Airport when he notified, he was flying about 120 miles an hour, when he notified Martha's Vineyard that he was coming in for a landing, perfectly normal voice, no mayday or warning of any trouble. Martha's Vineyard gave him the go-ahead. He was, from that point in, he was about 7.5 miles from Martha's Vineyard. The weather was excellent. There was no rain, there was no hail, there was no snow, there were no strong winds. Visibility was 2 to 5 miles, a little bit of haze on the island, but not much. And he could easily see the lights of the landing field. So at 7.5 miles out, the plane suddenly disappeared, just went down into the sea. Now, there were eyewitnesses on television, on Channel 7, who said they saw the plane coming in at about 100 feet. And there was one witness who claims he saw it at the moment it disappeared. He saw a big flash of white light, like an explosion. The plane sank approximately 7.5 miles from Martha's Vineyard, about 4 minutes out. Now, since he had already notified the landing field he was coming in, and it was a perfectly flat terrain, sandy island terrain, he would not be coming in at 1,800 feet. He'd be coming in at about 100. That'd be normal, 4 minutes from landing. The FAA, on the other hand, is claiming that he was at 1,800 feet, and the reason that the plane came apart so radically was because it hit so hard. Well, they're giving you strange figures, like the plane was supposedly flying 5,000 feet a minute, which sounds very, very big. But if you translate that into miles, he was driving about the speed of a car on a freeway, 60 miles an hour. A
couple of details I want to point out.
A lot of these facts just simply don't add up.
A couple of details before you go on. The Piper Saratoga has been reported by veteran pilots, and they were quoted in the papers as being a very, very stable aircraft, one that
it's
doesn't like to be. Yeah, it is one which, with any kind of decent pilot, will be able. They can get them out of a spiral like that. Also, I would point out that the paper said that John F. Kennedy had fewer than 100 hours flying time. Some said he had as few as 35. In fact, it later came out that he was a lifelong aviation buff with over 300 hours of flying time.
He had done more than double the number of hours needed.
And again,
to get his permit.
A few of the details that you've related. First of all, the weather wasn't hazy.
The weather was great.
The weather was
great. The only thing wrong was it was dark. I mean, it's always dark at night.
Yeah, and he had called Martha's Vineyard Airport, gotten clearance to land, was 7.5 miles, or about 4 minutes from the airport.
That's right.
With a visibility of 2 to 5 miles. And there is no credible explanation as to why he would be at 1,800 feet when he was coming into land. One of the things that first...
Well, the other thing, by the way, the first report into the FAA that the plane was missing came about half an hour after it disappeared, after 10 p.m. I guess it was an airport employee on Martha's Vineyard, called the FAA and said the plane did not come in. And the FAA said, we are not even watching the flight. We don't care about it. He didn't file a flight plan. He's a private citizen. He's of no interest to us, and we're not at all concerned about it. Later, they say they have recordings of radar scope which show him coming in at 1,800 feet and going through the spiral. I would like to see those radar scope recordings. I don't think they exist.
From a scientific standpoint, in terms of scientific methodology, the thing that first got me sniffing the air, other than the fact that it was President Kennedy's son, was the fact that for days they were saying, we don't know what happened, we don't know where it is, it was all this
rumination. It took 5 days to find the plane.
But throughout those 5 days, there was rumination about where it might be, what had happened, this and that, and then they produce a radar track purporting to be of the plane saying, this is what happened, this is where and this is when. They should have known.
All of a sudden, the White House took control of all press information, and there was an official story, and the official story blamed said it was an accident, it was no foul play, said that the whole thing was the fault of John F. Kennedy Jr. himself and his ineptitude as a nighttime flyer who did not know how to use instruments, and that he's because of the lack of instruments he had gone into what they call the dead man spiral. And it crashed. And this was the official story as usual, the American press corps did not question it in any way. I think an investigation is called for. I don't believe the story at all.
Let me just underscore that the coverage, as it was relayed, we don't know what happened, we don't know where it is, they're all this searching, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then the official version that said, well, here's this plane, here's the radar track, are mutually contradictory. They either knew or they didn't know where the plane was, and the two are in fundamental contradiction.
Well, the first report was that they did not know and they did not care. He had filed no flight plan, and they were not tracking him. They'd paid no attention to him. Now, the other thing, there are two other things of great importance here. I paid a lot of attention to television direct the couple of days immediately after the disappearance of the plane. I was watching TV news constantly on July 17th and July 18th. On July 17th, there was coverage from Martha's Vineyard, from the Kennedy compound, or Hyannisport, rather, that's where the compound is, that the Kennedy family was now making plans for burial of John F. Kennedy Jr. and his wife and his sister-in-law, and they were going to put John F. Kennedy Jr. in Arlington Cemetery as near as possible to the grave of his father. The other thing that broke after the body, three bodies and a fetus, were found, two Democratic congressmen, this is television coverage, two Democratic congressmen who were at Hyannisport commented that this was more of a tragedy than the nation understood, because the left side of the Democratic Party was planning to offer the nomination for either president or vice president to John F. Kennedy Jr. at the convention in the year 2000. Now, this would make him a very important political figure and give somebody a good motive for killing him.
John, you cite some very
also one more thing. In the Sunday talking heads shows, like Meet the Press, a number of reputable journalists, political experts, said that it was common knowledge in Washington, and had been for months, that John F. Kennedy Jr. was going to be offered the nomination.
And again, from stated sources, my guess is he probably would have gotten vice president rather than president, but that's an educated guess.
I don't think Al Gore's got a chance in hell.
Well, that's a separate subject. We're low on time. I agree with you as far as it goes.
Yeah. Let's talk about bringing in the bodies.
I want to remind listeners that an eyewitness saw a flash of light. Now, yes, the
handling of the bodies. Coverage.
The handling of the bodies and the wreckage was extraordinary. Tell us about that.
Well, there was a lapse between the plane coming down at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on July 16th, and its discovery and the removal of the bodies on July 22nd. There was more than 5 days. The bodies were found 7.5 miles, I believe it was northeast of Martha's Vineyard, in about 150 feet of water. The water is 52 degrees Fahrenheit, which preserved the bodies. They were still strapped in. They had their seat belts on. They were still in the fuselage. It took a number of hours to recover them. They were raised by a Coast Guard team at about 3-something in the afternoon of July 22nd. They were on land. They were landed at the Oceanographic Institute and Coast Guard base there, Woods Hole, that's what it's called, at approximately 4:30. Reporters were not allowed to even look at them. They were all zipped up in body bags. No one was allowed to have any contact or, you know, observation of the bodies.
How about autopsies?
They were put in a white van, which the New York Times ran a photo of, and taken to the county mortuary, the county morgue, and between dusk and midnight, the autopsies were done. Now, something extraordinary happened here. Under Massachusetts law, the autopsies must be photographed. But Senator Edward Kennedy, according to the New York Times, personally asked the mortuary, the morgue, not to photograph the bodies and the autopsies. No notes on those autopsies have ever been presented to the press, and no interviews have been allowed with the people who did the autopsies. The bodies were no sooner autopsied than less than 10 hours after being brought to land, they were burned. They were incinerated. The three adults and the fetus, the male fetus, they found in the belly of John F. Kennedy's wife. The This is extraordinary. It's destruction of evidence. It completely circumvents any chance of really investigating this case.
One of the points you make in
these people are Catholics. They don't incinerate. They don't cremate. They bury. They believe that the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And until 1963, cremation of Catholics was prohibited by papal law. And even now it's frowned upon, and the Kennedys would not normally have done it.
You also cite an unidentified observer of this extraordinary funerary procedure as saying, quote, the bastards got away with it. They got completely away with it.
And if they were going to be charged with anything, what would it be? Littering?
Indeed.
Littering the ashes in the sea?
Reminds me of Nietzsche in a phrase that he had, a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. John, a couple of points I want to make. The assassination of President Kennedy was once again on the political front burner when, in the wake of the Balkans War, President Yeltsin gave mm-hmm. President Clinton the KGB files on Lee Harvey Oswald, but he did so in a very public and ostentatious way. This could have been handled through channels at sub rosa, so nobody would have known.
Mm-hmm.
It was done in that kind of an ostentatious fashion. I think, to send a political message. And one more point I'd like to make is, and we haven't got time to discuss this in detail, but George Herbert Walker Bush's name crops up in the context of the Kennedy assassination in several different ways. He was reported to have filed a tip to the FBI on a John Bircher in Houston who turned out to be innocent, then was reported to have been sent by the CIA to Miami to gauge the reaction of the anti-Castro Cuban community.
Mm-hmm.
A CIA rebuttal on that was disproved by The Nation magazine, and most importantly, he was named to be director of Central Intelligence by former Warren Commission member Gerald Ford,
mm-hmm.
and in that position, he frustrated cooperation between the agency and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. This also from a man who was a close personal friend of George de Morenshield, the white Russian aristocrat and former Nazi spy, who was one of Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence handlers. I would also point out...
Well, the whole connection to what happened to the father is very interesting, because when John F. Kennedy Sr. was autopsied, the autopsy notes were burned, the photographs and drawings that were made of the autopsy were altered, his brain disappeared, and here we have another case where photographs are not allowed and the bodies are immediately burned.
And I'd also point out, too, that there's a court case which has been in the courts, a lawsuit about with regard to the contra drug trafficking filed by a former Green Beret named Bill Tyree.
Yeah, right.
And a mafioso, an Army colonel, and CIA paymaster, and according to many sources, Oliver North's bagman named Albert Vincent Caron,
right.
filed some, in effect, deathbed affidavits in which he claimed not only was he in Dealey Plaza with a rifle, but that he made payments to Jack Ruby, among others. The point being that the JFK assassination is once again is in a court of law, someplace it never really was, with the exception of Garrison's investigation. There's another point I'd like to make, John, before I turn the rest of the interview over to you, that the summer of 1999 saw the deaths of more than one Kennedy, and I'd like to read an obituary that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Thursday, August 12th of 1999, and this would put this death about 3 weeks after JFK Jr. This is a New York Times obit, Dateline New York, and headlined Anthony Stanislaus Radziwill. Anthony Stanislaus Radziwill, a television executive who received both Emmy and Peabody Awards, died Tuesday at New York Presbyterian Hospital. He was 40 and lived in Manhattan. Mr. Radziwill, the only son of Lee Bouvier Radziwill Ross and the late Prince Stanislaus Radziwill, had battled cancer for 10 years. He was close to his cousin, John F. Kennedy Jr., and each had been best man at the other's wedding. Talks about his broadcast career and goes on to say, the next year he joined ABC News as a producer on Primetime Live with Diane Sawyer and Sam Donaldson, specializing in investigative reporting. He worked on reports of the Rodney King beating, the Los Angeles riots, and the O.J. Simpson trial. His investigative work on neo-Nazism in the United States earned him a Peabody Award in 1990. Now, I would point out that that's right about the time he got cancer. Freedom of Information Act documents have indicated that the intelligence services of this and other countries have been able to give people cancer and assassinate them as early as 1954. I would also point out that there are numerous intelligence connections to the O.J. Simpson case, including evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the Kennedy assassination. So one cannot draw any conclusions about the death of Anthony Stanislaus Radziwill at the ripe old age of 40, about 3 weeks after his cousin and best friend and best man at each other's weddings died. But I think that this is interesting, particularly in light of the fact that it removed someone who knew a lot about JFK Jr. Now, you pointed out that the wreckage also raises some very interesting questions. Tell us, John, about that.
Well, reporters were not allowed to examine the wreckage. It was brought in already boxed on Coast Guard cutters and then sent off to a secret, closed, high-security hangar at Otis Air Force Base, Massachusetts, where it now reposes. About two Saturdays after the examiner blanked out the original JFK story, they blanked out the second major story, which was the first official report from the government on the JFK Jr. plane crash. It came from the National Safety Transportation Board, and it said that the original investigation, which has been being done in secret, showed that there there was no evidence of sabotage, they said. They said that the engine apparently was functioning right to the last, and they said there was no great damage to the frame of the plane, but they did note that they had only gotten 75% of the wreckage and that they had nothing from the tail. The tail was completely missing. This was supposed to be the first of a series of bulletins on the plane wreckage. Reporters, as I say, have not been allowed to look at the wreckage. No photographs have been released. No further reports have been issued in the last 6 weeks. The last time that the National Transportation Safety Board was asked about the matter, they said, well, there may be no further reports of any kind. So they have buried John F. Kennedy, Jr., and they're trying to bury the story, and I think an investigation is called for.
Well, I certainly think that the questions that you've raised in your article, again published in Anderson Valley Advertiser, L.A. Free Press, and now your Open City
publication. Now Open City, which is on the streets in San Francisco.
All righty. Well, this will...
35th anniversary issue.
Yep. This is...
Bring back the 60s.
Well, I think they're going to be bringing... They've already brought back some aspects, which is the assassinations. We'll see about the rest of it. But I want to stress that this is a story that I think people need to pay a lot of attention to, and I would also point out that George Herbert Walker Bush's name cropping up in the context of the assassination in several ways.
Well, there are people who are saying that it was suspicious that the son of the former head of the CIA should be running for president at exactly the time that John F. Kennedy Jr. Was being talked up for the Democratic nomination.
He took the words right out of my mouth.
Somebody who... It would not be unthinkable that if there was sabotage involved in this matter, that the person who did it was doing it on behalf of Bush.
That certainly
both father and son.
It certainly is something to bear in mind. Well, John, I want to thank you for your work, and I want to thank you for visiting with us today, because we are out of time, and your Open City publication promises to be asking these sorts of difficult questions.
We'll be out once a month from now on.
All righty. Well, I've been visiting with John Bryan, the publisher and editor of Open City. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.